Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining editor Simon Lamb and I today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, from May and Hammond to Johnson and Javid, top gear for your finances or a slip into reverse? Simon and Lee run through what a Boris government will mean for your money and your future. Will he really manage to succeed where those before him have failed and tackle the care crisis once and for all? Also, why you may want to think twice before logging into that public Wi-Fi, how you can fight the financial fosh, why going classic may be better when it comes to convertibles, and we celebrate the mundane. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, finally, Boris Johnson is where he wants to be. Perhaps not where everyone else wants him to be, though, but he's at number 10, and he's not wasted any time ringing in the changes. With more than half the cabinet gone, it is officially the biggest clear out in history, without a change of party in power, of course. So less a reshuffle, more a brand new government, it would seem. But what will that new government, as it were, mean for your finances, particularly the change at number 11? Well, last week, Simon, you and I looked at what a no-deal Brexit would mean for us. I guess that podcast hasn't aged. Still very relevant. But what about the other things, I guess, that you guys are keeping an eye on in the early days of Boris Johnson's new government? What sort of a man is he? And let's just stick to the politics here. We don't need to know any of the other details. Yeah, politically speaking, what sort of a guy is he, and therefore what can we expect when it comes to our money?
Boris is an ideas man, mm-hmm. not a details man, I think, is the general consensus. He is someone who likes to sit back, think of the grand plan, maybe pick up on other people's grand plans, and try to put some form of bold strategy into action to mm-hmm. deal with them. Details-wise, I believe, from everything I've heard, he's quite happy to leave that to everyone else. So that makes it quite interesting, because I think we can get a gist of some of his thoughts from mm-hmm. his widely reported upon and lucrative for Boris newspaper column in the Daily Telegraph, which he's been writing for some years. And he has managed to become Prime Minister by not standing in a general election. Therefore, there's not been the same scrutiny of a manifesto and policies that there would usually be. Mm-hmm. He's managed to do it in a slightly odd Tory leadership contest, I think, by any standards. And that means that he has managed to become Prime Minister with only the most loosely defined set of policies, if you could even describe them as that. So much of the things that have, in fact, been put forward as Boris policies, there's very little evidence of them actually having come out of Boris's mouth or being written by Boris. He has managed to do it with only some very loosely defined policies. So what do we know? Well, some of those loosely defined policies reflect upon directly our personal finances and the nation's finances. So we have the hint of a stamp duty cut. Boris agrees stamp duty is a problem. Stamp duty is stopping people moving. Stamp duty is affecting first-time buyers. There's talk of removing everybody out of stamp duty up to £500,000, not just first-time buyers. There's talk of reversing the stamp duty hikes that George Osborne brought in for properties further up the market, which, when George Osborne did a good thing by changing stamp duty from a crazy slab-style system where the percentages went up above a threshold, but you paid that top percentage on the entire purchase price. Mm-hmm. There aren't many other taxes that are constructed like that. It's not considered a good way to construct a tax. He changed it to being like income tax. So as you step over the threshold, you start to pay the higher percentage. But in order to dodge worries that he would be seen to be giving money to the rich, although actually rich people buying expensive houses is taking money off the rich, but we'll leave that for another day, he decided to hit them with extra stamp duty. Now, this has caused all kinds of problems because it's combined with a number of other things, largely very expensive houses, and is definitely a factor in people not moving or moving less. So it's, you know, stamp duty has grown over the years from a tax that, when Gordon Brown came into power, was a flat 1% only on properties above £60,000. It became a way of cashing in on rising property prices and has now gone so far that it's essentially, for a lot of people, I think it's taken about one or two moves out of their lifetime. So it costs so much to move now that people are just like, oh, I just stay put. Now, Boris is gone, this is a problem, I'm going to sort it. Exactly how, we don't know, because there was this talk of removing people up to £500,000, reversing the higher end. But then there was also talk of, oh, well, maybe we should make the seller pay it rather than the buyer, which would be a radical overhaul. We then have talk about lowering taxes. So we have lifting the 40% higher rate tax threshold up from the £50,000 that it is meant to be at to £80,000, which is essentially a tax cut for the richer members of society, for the wealthier members of society. But also there's been talk of, well, we must do something for people lower down as well. There's also talk of sorting out the social care mess, and there's an expectation that he might make that something of a cornerstone. We have a big problem with social care. We have kicked the can down the road. You think we've been kicking the can down the road on Brexit? You should see what we've been doing on social care for a number of years. I was listening to Andrew Dilnot, who carried out a famous review that was never enacted, on the radio this morning, and he was actually saying it's not even that expensive. It's just governments just have completely lacked the willingness to deal with it. And the last time that it was talked about being dealt with, Theresa May's disastrous manifesto that somehow reversed a cap and made it a flaw and turned into arguments about dementia tax. So there's talk of doing this. And also, in terms of the nation's finances, Boris is the kind of guy who looks like he's going to loosen the purse strings. Lower taxes, more spending, energise, as he said the other day. And he's going to be a lot less worried about the austerity that we're still meant to be finishing off. And I think also just one final point is I think he's the kind of person who he's a crowd pleaser and he likes to be liked. But I think he's going to be a lot less concerned about introducing policies that he just gets lambasted as saying, well, you're just helping the rich. Because I think he's probably going to say, well, I can probably spin them so that people like them.
Probably, if anyone can, he can. So far, so traditionally conservative sounding to a degree, Lee, I think, you know, tax cuts for the rich. So actually also London centric to a degree, housing crisis and all that. And he was, of course, London mayor. Your thoughts about our new prime minister?
I think Boris is a bit too smart for that. I think we don't give him enough credit. The cabinet decisions that he's made, and you know, we can't call it a reshuffle. It's more just a completely new government. He's really sort of gone in, and he's obviously thought about this for a long time because, you know, for the last couple of months, it's been pretty clear that it was going to take a miracle to stop Boris Johnson becoming prime minister since Theresa May announced that she was going to step down. And the ones that are kind of going to affect the pound in your pocket and the ones to really keep an eye on. So Amber Rudd is actually a rare minister that's staying put, so she's going to still be working pensions. We've got Andrea Leadsom, who's going to be business minister. We've got Liz Truss, who's going to be international trade. Now, one of the interesting ones was Robert Jenrick, who's going to be the new housing minister. Now, the reason why I say that that's quite interesting is, A, you're looking at me like, who on earth is that? Which is what a lot of people...
about the 1800th in the last five minutes,
but
isn't he?
Quite interestingly, he's 37 years old. So he's quite a young guy in terms of a senior ministerial post. And he will, I would suspect, or you'd like to think, that he'd have more of a finger on the pulse when it comes to those buying issues. And I think that's where... Yeah, first-time buyer issues for the younger generation, right? That has been the political football that's been kicked around, not quite as hard as Brexit, but definitely has been the underbubbling second most important thing behind that in the last couple of years. Now, I would have thought that he has his finger on the pulse a little bit more, the sort of struggles that first-time buyers are having at that age, you would suspect. And you wonder if that's a kind of Boris Johnson move of thinking, well, hold on, let's get someone a bit younger as housing minister and see what they can do with it. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the big one is the new Chancellor, Sajid Javid, who is a massive Maggie Thatcher fan. You know, I hear he has a picture of her in his office.
He grew up
in his wallet. He's got a background in banking, did that for many years. And we've got rumours of an emergency budget perhaps coming very soon. So, George,
what will that mean?
It's exciting times. Well, we'd hear what, you know, it would involve Boris and him, I guess, sitting down and revealing the details and what this plan that Boris has that's been light on detail thus far, what it actually will mean.
Lee, explain to me how we've had so many, because we were talking about it last week, Simon and I, about the seemingly never-ending battle for this leadership position that's gone on when perhaps they could have been discussing other more important things like Brexit negotiations and the like, and how we didn't have more detail being drilled out of these, these candidates.
First of all, there was like 10 candidates, so it's quite difficult to give the airtime for every single candidate.
We got down to the two,
and then we get down to the two, and then it's kind of... you know, it's not the same scrutinies that would usually be out there in a general election or when someone's actually fighting for votes from the general public rather than just the party. You know, it's been very light on detail. Boris was obviously grilled a lot about the detail, and he did his classic jovial blustering.
Get a kipper out and wave it around. Yeah.
You know, and it's how well thought out some of these plans are. And then you have to consider between now and Halloween, which is the date allegedly we're going to finally Brexit.
Brilliant date.
Brilliant date for it. But how much time he's going to be able to dedicate to these all of these issues that are kind of just stuck in first gear because, you know, Brexit is swallowed up so much time for all the public servants that are, you know, involved in the process, and the process that just feels like it is going nowhere. So it's hard to know what percentage of Boris's time is going to be able to be spent outside of, you know, Brexit negotiations, if there's going to be any negotiations. So
yeah,
it's going to be an interesting, very, very, very interesting next few months, isn't it, Georgia? I can't quite see what's going to happen, but I'll tell you what, I'm quite excited.
Yeah, there are other words I would perhaps use. I'm just wondering, Simon, do you think an election's going to be called anytime?
I wouldn't
imagine. Is Brenda from Bristol going to be doorstopped?
I wouldn't imagine that we'd get one until at least October the 31st. I highly doubt that Boris would call an election between now and then. There's talk of a snap election before then in order to get some kind of mandate, but
That didn't work so well for the Tories last time, did it?
No. You know, there's a famous line that says the best way of losing an election is to call one. I just think he'd look at it and go, well, why would I do that? There's a chance I'd lose it. And I'd rather at least, I don't want to be the person who was Prime Minister for 6 weeks.
Yeah, true.
So no, I don't think there will be. And also, I think that one of the things about Boris is, and he would not have been my choice for Prime Minister. I don't think he's the best person to be Prime Minister of this country.
Who is?
I don't know, but nor do I want him to fail, as so many people seem to want to, and as so many people seem to want to with so many things nowadays.
Good point, Simon.
They basically actively want failure. They want to see us fail. I don't want him to fail, not because I want to see Boris Johnson's ego massaged any further, but because I want what is best for Britain, and him failing would be bad news for the country.
Simon for PM, Ailey.
Yeah,
Simon,
yeah. Definitely. Yeah, I'll vote for you.
Will Philip Hammond be missed?
The complete eradication of all Help To schemes.
Yes, indeed.
I think the thing about Boris that doesn't get picked up on, and I think this is one of the key things with politicians, is I think Boris gets it, right? You either get it or you don't get it. You get the mood of people. You get what people think. You get what their concerns are. And there's so much stuff that we don't tackle that really gets people's goats, and we don't do anything about it, or we just do endless reviews and things like that, and they never get fixed. And I think that he is the kind of person who gets it. Now, you might want to call some of that populism. Maybe some of it is populism. But I don't think he is a mini Trump. But I think that he is the kind of person who gets it. And to be honest, I'm not sure Theresa May was.
No, I'd agree with you. And I also, to a certain degree, don't think Philip Hammond was either. He be missed?
No.
And will Sajid Javid get it?
Javid does to a certain extent. But I also think it's ironic that we have a number of people, you know, Tory leaders who have been heavily criticised for being very wealthy, multimillionaires, that kind of thing. And actually, there doesn't appear to be a direct relationship between the two things. You'd think that, you know, the richer they are, the more gilded they are, these old Etonians, they just don't get it, kind of thing. But actually, some of them do. Cameron got it with what people thought. He pulled a disastrous move calling that referendum in the way he did. But he did get it. I think, you know, Johnson gets it. I think, in a way, actually, the real appeal of Jeremy Corbyn to people, beyond all of the other sort of baggage that comes with him, is that he gets it as well. He gets it with what people have beef about and what they're upset about. And I think McDonald does as well. So, you know, maybe that bodes well for the future. Who knows?
Who knows? But one of those things that Simon mentioned, Lee, about what Boris Johnson, is looking to fix once and for all is Britain's care crisis. It was a thing that stood out, in his speech for me, certainly, that was, let's be honest, big on promises, lacking in specifics. And perhaps you're right, Simon, perhaps he was mindful of Theresa May's dementia tax debacle, I think. His quote was, "We will fix the social care once and for all with a clear plan that we have prepared to give every older person the dignity and security they deserve." The reason this stood out for me, Lee, is because I had a terrible experience with this last year with both my grandparents, and this is something that I think that we do need to take more seriously. And apparently the money is there, is that right? Or it's not that expensive. So why... Firstly, outline the task at hand.
I was going to say, Georgie, you're not alone. More and more people are feeling this way, I would suspect. You know, it's very difficult when you have parents or grandparents that need care. They can't stay in their own homes anymore because it's just too difficult and it's too much of a strain on family life. And they need to go into a care home. Now, the trouble is, care fees can be eye-wateringly expensive.
Unbelievable.
Depending on your location, but also depending on the quality of care. You know, there are care homes that are far better than others, and it can run into, you know, an average of like £1,000 a week. You know, that is a lot of money, and that can soon swallow up savings, property, sale, all that type of thing very, very quickly, depending on how long you might need that care home help.
And of course, you don't know.
And I think a lot of time, it's so sad, but I think a lot of people, older people, feel like they just want to pass away pretty quickly because they don't want to be a burden.
Really?
No, but you know what I mean? Yeah, it's really like you don't want to be a financial burden. You don't want to be an emotional burden on people. It's a bit of a sad topic, but it's one of those things. It needs a radical overhaul. We've heard all sorts of different ways that this may be tackled. We've had, for instance, rumblings and rumours of a new ISA. You know you like that, Georgie. A care ISA. Yeah. I knew that would get your eyes rolling. But something has to be done. I think the big problem is people don't think about, and rightly so, you don't really think about, you might have thought about your retirement, but you're probably not likely then thinking about after what happens after retirement when you're in that kind of time when you fall into ill health. And there's stats out there that people have between, on average, 15 to 20 years of declining health.
Is there an assumption that the state will provide?
I think there is an assumption, but the stark reality is that it won't. If you're a homeowner especially, it just won't, you know, because it just doesn't work that way. And councils are, in a word, when it comes to social care, bankrupt. You know, they don't have the facilities to pay for everyone in their area's care needs. It's impossible. And we're becoming an older population. That's been well documented. You know, more of us are living for longer, which is great in one hand and is testament to things like the NHS. But on the other hand, it's creating a huge burden on local councils. And it's becoming one of those things that we just cannot continue to bury our head in the sand over. Something needs to be done. Boris Johnson, as Simon was saying there, you know, I feel like he does have a finger on the pulse as to what people care about and want. That dementia tax, I mean, dementia tax, just say that out loud, and it is almost, it is one of the most sort of politically sort of death-defying moments I can particularly think about. I mean, it is hideous just to say. So he's right to be looking into that. We had the whole review in 2011, as Simon said earlier, that had a number of measures in there that could help, and it sounds like it wouldn't be as expensive as you think. And I think Simon's got more on that.
Thank you, Lee. If we had something in 2011, then why 8 years later have we got a Prime Minister in his first speech saying that this is something I am going to fix once and for all? Why has it not been done before?
Just a bit of a failure of people in power, to be perfectly honest, and a combination of that with circumstance. You know, 2011, we're still trying to claw our way back from the financial crisis, recession. You know, we never sought it then. We get a new government. We never quite go, OK, well, we're actually a failure, an unwillingness to commit to a certain solution, and then Brexit, you know, that just means nothing's really been done, to be honest. And I mean, care fees for nursing care have hit an average of £844 a week last year. So that's £44,000 a year, basically. Now, the thing is if you don't have any property or savings, then the council, you know, will pick up the tap. But if you do, then you've got to pay that yourself. And then depending upon your personal situation, whether you have a partner who lives in the house with you and things like that, you can find yourself, you know, at risk of losing your home. And the families who are worst hit are those with property and savings worth more than £23,250, who have to pay the full cost of care themselves. Councils contribute if you have more than £14,250 between that level. And they pay all the fees if you have less. But those thresholds mean that almost every homeowner faces fees. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, if you need to be looked after and you have an asset that's worth lots of money, then perhaps you should use some of that asset in order to pay for those fees. But it's a very emotive subject, and people can see the value of their home swiftly eaten up because there's not enough money being put into social care. Care homes are, and the councils are cash strapped. Care homes are being forced to effectively offer the councils where they're paying cheaper rates, and then they're subsidised by charging private individuals higher rates. And then you have the scenario where we wanted to bring in a system whereby there was a cap. So yes, you could eat into the value of your assets and your savings and your property, but it would only be up to a certain amount. And once you'd done that certain amount, the government would pick up the tab. And then you wouldn't have to sell your home whilst you were alive. That money could be taken from your estate when you sold it after death, that kind of thing. And if you introduce a proper system like that and you get people on board and get people behind it, then I think it would work. There's been talk of an insurance-based system. Andrew Dilnett said earlier and has said repeatedly before that he doesn't think a private insurance-based system would work, because if a private insurance-based system would work, we'd have a private insurance-based system. So there has to be a kind of government-backed one. Whether that means, you know, an extra bit of tax coming from people that goes into a specific social care fund and is ring-fenced, whether that means it comes from everybody's tax, whether it only comes from, you know, tax for older people, who knows? But we do need to deal with this problem. And the problem with the whole what got branded the dementia tax was somehow that cap managed to turn into a floor, and that you would have to pay a certain amount. So it's a bit of a mess, but it's not an unfixable mess. It's not an unsortable mess. We just need a bit of gumption and a bit of wherewithal in order to get it done. And to be honest, everyone was reasonably happy with the whole Dilnett review stuff. So it mystifies me why we haven't put a version of that in place yet. Well, absolutely mystifies
me. The thing we also need is a little bit of focus, and I think our focus has been directed elsewhere quite substantially.
There's also the issue where it's a bit of a lottery. You don't know whether it's going to hit you. And actually, the vast majority of people will not run up substantial care fees. But a minority of people will get unlucky and run up a very high amount of care fees. And it doesn't just affect people who go into homes. It also affects those who need help whilst they're still at home. And that's a big thing for people, you know, helping people to stay in their home, helping them to be there. And just someone coming in a couple of hours a day and can make an absolutely huge difference to people. But again, that all of a sudden starts to become very, very costly for certain people.
Is there anything we can do just briefly ourselves, at I suppose any stage in life, in terms of cushioning the blow later on?
Well, there's one argument that says that families don't do enough to help. There's an argument that says that people don't do so much to help their own families nowadays, and that families should be, you know, helping more as they used to, care through the generations. But it's very difficult. People live very fragmented lives nowadays. And what do you do if someone lives at the opposite end of the country to you? It's very difficult to go and help in that scenario. So, and then
in terms of financially speaking, should we start saving?
Well, you could start saving some money for it. But the problem is people tend to leave this kind of saving until quite late in life, and it's very difficult to build up a substantial pot over a very short period of time. One option, for example, is to encourage people that once they've got the mortgage paid off. So, say for example, you end up paying off your mortgage in your mid to late 50s, and you don't retire until your mid to late 60s, that you divert that instead of pocketing the money that you would have otherwise been spending on mortgage payments, you divert that into a specific savings or investment scheme to help try and cover you for care in later years. And actually, if you did that and you invested it and then you left the money invested in your mid-60s, chances are you might not need care until your 80s, and then you've got another 10 or more years of growth on top of that. But people find it very difficult to save for things anyway, so, you know, and their income's going to drop in retirement. So really, they've only got that gap between, you know, that's if they've got their mortgage paid off. We've got a whole generation taking 40-year mortgages now.
So. Yeah, absolutely. All right, if we get more detail on this, we will, of course, return to this subject. I'm sure we'll return to Boris Johnson's new government. perhaps once or twice in the future. We'll see. But let's move on from that, because long gone are the days that you'd go to a coffee shop just for a, you know, cup of tea, coffee, chin wag. They look more like those sort of working spaces. You know, everybody's got a laptop. Everyone's got their phones out. Public Wi-Fi is a thing. I'll have a bucket of milk, a little bit of coffee, and your Wi-Fi code, please. But the question is, how safe is it, Lee? Because from your sister paper, The Mail on Sunday, reporter Toby Warne spent a day with a security expert in order to find out. But what I want to know, Lee, because you are Lee the Scam Man, is do you ever log on to public Wi-Fi? If you say no, I am never logging on to public Wi-Fi again.
Okay, there's two elements to this, Georgie. Okay. When you said go into a coffee shop and get a coffee and the Wi-Fi code, the key is there, you need a code to log in.
Okay, okay.
But what's happening now with a lot of public Wi-Fi is they're trying to make it more simple.
Like the cloud or something.
Trying to make it simpler. So they basically don't have a code. You just like, you know, you log in, this is free Wi-Fi, and you don't need to have a password or anything. Yeah. You can just get in.
It's like the Tube, right?
It's like the Tube. Yeah, exactly. So it's there to be manipulated by scammers and fraudsters, I'm afraid. And I remember writing about this a very long time ago. I'm talking about maybe 6 or 7 years ago, in which we did a warning not to use, or especially don't keep your Wi-Fi on at all times. Anyway, I mean, it drains your battery, but it also means that fraudsters can pick up on your Wi-Fi. But you are at danger if you log in to Wi-Fi outside of your home with something that doesn't require any kind of password. And a classic one for that is coffee shop at hotels. A lot of us just get into a hotel, think, well, we've paid for this hotel, I want the Wi-Fi. You go onto the Wi-Fi. A lot of them, you do have a code. So you're given a specific code that might run out after your stay or whatnot. But a lot of them now are just making it very simple.
You just have to give them your email address and then they'll spam you in the future.
One of the classic ones that does the rounds is, let's say you are going to Pret. I'm just going to use Pret as an example. I'm not saying this has ever happened.
There are other coffee shops available.
Just using this as an example. You might go in there and there might be more than one Pret on your Wi-Fi list. So there might be Pret Coffee Shop, Pret. People might be setting them up as Wi-Fi hotspots to then, you know, mimic whatever you're doing online. You might be putting in your credit card details to buy something. You know, we're all online shopping now. You might be checking your online banking. They can get into your phone, start getting all of your contacts. Absolute minefield of information that they can download very, very quickly. And it's pretty inexpensive to do. There's a couple of devices that can be used to do that, to create a Wi-Fi hotspot, to be able to hack into your phone and take the data. What I would say is that don't go into a coffee shop and think, oh, I can never use the Wi-Fi. Because you're right, there are a lot of people now. It actually drives me a bit mad, George, if I'm being honest with you, watching everyone in there with their laptops. It's like the new office. Yeah. It's like, oh, please.
Taking up all the seats and all the space.
Yeah,
and,
I'll just work from home. Or, I know you want to get out of the house. I'm being cruel. If you do that, I'm sorry.
But, no, you're not.
No, I'm not. But you've just got to be really mindful, because we've seen fraud and scams online grow year in, year out, as more and more people rely on the internet basically to function. And there's quite a lot of telltale signs out there. Some people are just a bit naive and will just trust whatever's there, and they'll just log into it and do it.
Is it a question, though, Lee, of it's okay so long as you don't look into anything private? So say you're just Googling, I don't know, the football latest updates or whatever, that's okay, but don't log into anything like your email or your
that kind of works in a way, but they can kind of get in anyway, and perhaps even if you don't end up typing in passwords or, you know, personal financial data, they can still potentially comb your laptop for other information, depending on how you've logged in.
And same with your phone, presumably.
Same with your phone, yeah. And I think, you know, a couple of things you can do to arm yourself against this is to make sure, obviously, firstly, that you're logging into the genuine Wi-Fi of said shop or said hotel.
Worth asking at
reception. It's worth asking. You know, sometimes the most basic, stupid questions are the right questions to ask. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to ask these things. It's better than getting scammed, isn't it?
Yeah.
And make sure, you know, basically, you've got a good antivirus software. It should be able to pick up on these sort of things. If you're, you know, even on your phone, you should really have, a lot of people have their security deactivated, have the antivirus stuff deactivated, because it does drain a bit of battery. It does run in the background. But if you are someone that does log into your online bank quite a lot on your phone, if you are putting in a lot of personal details, email addresses, other personal information, I would say it's probably worth having it activated, or at least having it activated while you're out of the house, for example, to see, you know, at least then you've got another shield against this type of thing. If you're someone that typically goes out to coffee shops, hotels, uses Wi-Fi quite a lot, you want to make sure you do that. Now, again, this is not to scaremonger people from ever doing this.
How common do you really think this is?
There's no real hard and fast data around it, so you can't really tell. It's quite difficult to really pinpoint figures in it. But it does happen. People are out there. There are scammers that will, you know, specifically set out, especially hotels. Hotels, we're told from security experts, are the kind of real hotspots that this is happening in.
Yeah.
You think they're quite vast spaces, something like a reception area. A lot of people, again, are down there with their laptops, etc., can easily hide devices that they're using to, you know, try and siphon off information from people. It's just about being mindful and making sure that you're doing things correctly, logging into the right thing, and not just blindly. I think there's this danger of blindly going, oh, you know, there's four or five different intercontinental hotel Wi-Fis, or this one's got the strongest signal, I'll click on that one, that'll be fine. And you go in, it could be anyone. You know, you want to make sure you are doing the right thing. It's simple advice, but it could save you from being defrauded.
A lot of hassle and save you a lot of money as well. All right, well, let's move on to something that probably comes as no surprise to mums and dads. School holidays are long and they are expensive. And I'm going to go to Simon because, Lee, you've got all this to come, my friend. Parents spend, on average, £1,500 entertaining their kids for 6 to 8 weeks. And that doesn't even include the additional childcare costs. So how can you bring down that cost without curbing the entertainment? You have a number of top tips. I won't get you to go through all of them. You can find these on This Is Money. But firstly, what is costing us so much, Simon?
Keeping the kids occupied.
Yeah.
Kids have annoyingly short attention spans. And also adults just feel compelled nowadays to fill their time and take them places and not just leave them to get bored. If you leave a child to get bored for long enough, it will find something to do.
You need to keep
an eye on them just in case. What they find to do. But also we're much more reluctant nowadays to let our children go play by themselves. So, I mean, my children are only 8 and 6. They're a bit young for that. But, you know, when I was a kid, when I was 8, I'd just go out and play outside the house. You know, but I luckily lived in a cul-de-sac that was kind of out of town. But, you know, we'd go off and play with the other kids. We lived on the verge of the countryside. When I was a little bit older than that, we'd just vanish off and come back hours later. People are very reluctant to do that nowadays. Would I let my daughter vanish off for, you know, a couple of hours where I don't know where she is in a year or two's time? I'm not sure I would, even though I'm a great proponent of that kind of thing. So we feel the need to fill it with stuff. And obviously the modern world involves lots of businesses trying to take our money off us in order to do stuff that fills that time. The most expensive thing listed in this survey was the family holiday at £860. I wish my family holiday was going to cost me £860. Yeah. Anyway, here's some tips. Inevitably, they are going to spend some time probably using some form of tablet or iPad or something like this. Don't just let them rot their brain with those awful cartoons on Netflix. Download them some kids' activity apps, and the best of these will basically get them involved in doing something that actually gets them out of the house and does some activities. There's also apps that will encourage kids to do exercise, to have adventures, to do things like that. And there's ones that will get them to do learning. You know, some of these games are great learning tools. And, you know, your kids have got 6 weeks off school. By the time they go back, they might have forgotten everything they've ever been taught. Of course they won't. But, you know, you can keep their brains alive. Find out if your council offers free events. Councils, much as we bemoan them, do lots and lots of really good stuff. And councils do some really good stuff around things to do with kids that is either free or very, very good value. For example, you might find that your council has some form of holiday club where it costs a fraction of what it would cost you to put your kids in a private holiday club. You can use your childcare vouchers in order to pay for a lot of stuff that does cost you money. And that means that, you know, when you're paying for childcare in the holidays, not just in the school time, you can do that. Sign up to the National Trust. You get some discounts and things like that. See whether your kids or any other financial provider that you've got, or your workplace, okay? Lots of people's workplaces, if you work for a big company, have a discount scheme that will get you money off days out. You can get money off anything ranging from theme parks to attractions to traditional days out. Visit a museum. Lots of museums are free. Go to the library. Libraries are also free. Look at group buying. Can you get some discounts if you team up with other people? If you team up with other people, can you get them to, you know, swap days looking after the kids? Get down the park. So basically, the best free stuff out there is parks,
yeah,
woodland, the countryside. Get your kids to go paddling in the river, swimming in the river. That costs absolutely
really?
Nothing. You can it's have safe. A great day out. Of course it's safe. Children have been swimming and paddling in rivers for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Just pay attention. Look at. Just get off your own phone and pay attention to them while they're doing it. And yes, if you need to get out of town to do that, then you might have to drive somewhere. You might have to get the train. But, you know, that you can get discounted train tickets.
Yeah.
Last Sunday, we went out to a place near Hartford called Hartham Common, which is on the outskirts of the town. It's a beautiful kind of meadow on one side, and then you've got some parkland on the other. There are four rivers that meet there: the River Rib, the River Bean, the River Mimram, and the River Lee. The River Bean is wide enough, lazy enough, and deep enough to swim in. Absolutely brilliant day. It's also super clean. I know this because my father-in-law was a farmer, now works as a farm inspector doing the red tractor stuff, and a lot of the farms go through that river that's in Hertfordshire, and he's seen the water reports. He says it's super clean. Some of the other rivers are super clean. People worry about, you know, danger and rivers not being clean and all these other things. Look, it's fine. Rivers haven't been this clean in decades. Get out there, have some fun. Take, you know, if you don't like the river, go to the woods, go to the fields, go for a walk. Do some stuff that's free. We live in a beautiful country, and there's loads of stuff you can do for free.
I was just laughing there because we used to go out quite a lot to the woodlands and all that. And my dad recently told me a story. I must have been about 5 years old, that we were walking along the side of the road, and he looked back, and little old me had gone missing. What I'd done is I'd slipped and fallen down a ditch into the water, fully clothed. What I would say is, if you are going to go swimming or falling into a ditch, don't do it fully clothed, because it sort of pees everybody off a little bit, that is your day out ruined.
So I will give you three reasons why that was a good thing. One, you had an adventure. Two, you learned a valuable life lesson. Three, you had a story that you could tell for the rest
true.
Of your life.
But I didn't remember it. My dad is dining out, so I don't even know that's true.
I will say that for all of the things I just said, there is one chief problem here for a lot of people, and that is that they have to go to work. And the main problem with the school holidays for people is getting their kids looked after, because most people can't take the whole of the school holidays off. 6 weeks is a very long time, and it can be very difficult to get your kids looked after. And there, if you want to save money on that, I highly recommend things like looking to see what your council does, seeing if you can use your tax-free childcare vouchers and things like that, and maybe trying to team up with other people locally to help out, because that is the really, really tough thing for most people.
And sweet talk your friends and family as well.
Yeah.
I was going to say, three things I would suggest. The library, when I was a kid, that was what I started my summer holidays. Every year there was like a reading club. You used to go in, get your books, you'd read, you'd get your stickers, you'd go back in. And it really, you know, developed my love of reading. So I would definitely say library's a good one. Getting out there, going something, looking at something like the Ordnance Survey map website. They've got hundreds of free walks on there. There might be walks in your local area that you would never have even known about that are mapped out. You can go and have a look. I do that all the time. It sounds so sad, but we love going out for a walk. And within a hour radius of us, there are thousands upon thousands of walks. This country's beautiful. Yeah. Just get out there and walk more. And the other thing I would say is keep an eye out on things like promotions. So, for example, we bought some butter the other week, Country Life butter, and it had 2-for-1 on all English Heritage sites. And I think there's one going on with soap at the moment where you can go to all Merlin attractions, buy one, get one free. So if you are in the market to do something like that, where they do tend to be quite expensive, would A, see if you can find a promotion. B, if you can't, book online in advance, because you can get tickets for this stuff. It tends to be a good 10-20% cheaper if you book online before you go.
I've just one tip as well. I read this brilliant thing the other day, and this Google this and you will find it. It's free to read. It's published by some kind of issue site. It's called ISSUU, Read Magazines, but it's free. You don't have to pay for it. It's not a subscription thing. And this one is called The Wild Guide, and it's Southern and Eastern England, Hidden Places, Great Adventures, and The Good Life. Now, I'm guessing that maybe they've got these for other parts of the country as well. So sorry to all of the people who don't live in London and the South East who are our listeners, but I'm guessing you might be able to find these for the rest of the country too. But it was brilliant. It's like 130 pages of like good places to go and great places to go and see. And the vast majority of these probably won't cost you any money.
All right. Well, on that theme, it's summertime. In case you hadn't noticed, it may make you dream of owning a convertible. Those few days of sunshine that we have can be very persuasive. But if you still accept the famous changeable British weather and you want to go topless, cars I mean, please, gentlemen, for God's sakes, just the cars. Should you go new or should you go classic? You're right there, Lee.
No, sorry, I'm just going to keep living fit.
It's because it's warm. That's what it is. It's the summer. Would you go for a classic convertible, Lee? I kept trying to think. Every time I think of this story, I think, do you remember Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince? And they're going around riding their Jeeps and their Benzos, whatever it is.
In the summertime.
In the summertime. And I won't sing.
Are you asking me if I would buy a convertible?
Yeah.
No.
All right. Okay, Simon, this question is for you then. Classic or new convertible? What's the story about?
The story is about the fact that if you are tempted by the hot, sunny summer weather to go out and buy a convertible, and convertible sales do rise over summer, then you have a choice. You can either buy a brand new car, or you could go for something a bit older that might have a bit of sort of classic status, might be emerging classic, might already be a classic. And what you will have the advantage of is perhaps your motoring won't be as reliable. Perhaps you won't have the 3-year warranty that you'll get on a new car. Perhaps you won't be able to do it on a PCP deal as you can a new car. But it also won't lose value in the same way. So basically, most of the money that people lose on cars doesn't come from keeping them on the road, doesn't come from the cost of running them. It comes from depreciation. A new car will lose roughly a third of its value in the first 3 years, and then continue to lose a third of that value from that point on subsequently. If you buy an old car that's considered a bit of a classic, then you probably will retain its value, might even go up. Don't always bank on classic car values going up. They can go down as well. Probably won't lose a third of its value every 3 years. So you could have a new smart 4.2 cabriolet for the same price as a Fiat X19. That was a little angular Fiat. Now you might be slightly concerned about the reliability on that one. Or you could have a new Mazda MX-5, £20,000, or a Jaguar XJS V12 convertible, the expected value of which, according to our expert, in 2024 could be £30,000. So it could be worth more money. You could have a BMW 4 Series convertible, very popular, see a lot of them on the roads, £40,000, or you could have an Aston Martin DB9 Volante. Same price, probably going to hold its value, probably going to go up in value, almost certainly going to cost you much more money to run, but won't lose a third of its value in 3 years. You could have a new Jaguar F-Type V6, £60,000 that will cost you, or you could have a Lamborghini Gallardo Spider. You could have a Lamborghini, yes. The expected value of which in 2024 is £80,000, although, as I said, don't bank on that. But, I mean, a Lamborghini is going to be expensive to run. You're going to need to budget for a couple of £1,000 a year to keep that on the road. But you do have to balance that against the fact that your Jaguar F-Type that you buy new for £60,000 will only be worth about £40,000 in 3 years' time. And then going even further up the scale, if you were going to go completely bananas and buy yourself a brand new Lamborghini SVJ Roadster, which is highly unlikely,
Yeah. You
would pay £375,000.
Good Lord.
I know. Or you could buy a Rolls-Royce Silver Cloud 2 DHC, 1959 to 1962, for the same amount of money, which is predicted to go up in value by £50,000. But, I mean, you know, let's be honest. Who listening to this is going to buy a £375,000 car?
If you do, do get in contact and let us know and send us a photo.
If you are the person listening to this who is going to buy a £375,000 car, please do drop us a note.
It just looks like I've got it here. Do you remember Transformers? Robots in disguise. Mm. It looks just like one of them. Do you not think? A little bit. It looks like it could transform into a robot.
Yes, it could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's what makes it worth the money.
No, I would hope not. All right, well, there you go. So in sum, classic or new?
I'd go classic every time. I'd go classic every time, but then that's my preference. You know.
I'd go classic. I did actually have a time when I was thinking about buying an old MX-5, because then I thought, no, I just lit two Essex.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, fine. So Lee is a neither one. But if you do, like Lee, think that convertibles are just a little bit flash for you, then fear not, there is such a thing, I kid you not, as the Festival of the Unexceptional. The classic car show for drab heroes of yesteryear. What?
I love this. This is brilliant. This is an event that's in Buckinghamshire that's been going for a few years. And actually, a lot of cars that we kind of, you know, I'm a bit younger than you two, but even I remember, like, there was a lot more sort of older cars on the road. Then we had the scrappy scheme, and then a lot of them sort of got binned off. Mm-hmm. But some of them are absolutely fantastic. I love looking at the old cars that I kind of used to see on the road quite a lot. And it, basically people just turn up to look at very, very, very good examples of what were once very familiar cars that have perhaps been restored or have been bought almost factory fresh and left in a garage somewhere to be with low mileage on the clock. And people go in and have a look around at these examples. And I think it's brilliant. And it actually, when I read this story from our motoring correspondent, Rob Pohl, I thought back to some of the cars that my parents owned, including a Fiat Uno. My mum had has a real thing for Fiat. She's only owned Fiat's Puntos, but she used to have an Uno that was like a fridge on wheels. It was so square. You used to have to wind down all of the windows because no air got in, even in the winter. It was absolutely hideous. And then I started thinking about my dad's old Ford Mondeo. He was a classic Mondeo man in the late 80s and early 90s. And just how great a car that was. And I remember when he first got it brand new and it was on the driveway and being, you know, quite young, and quite impressed by the humble Mondeo. And I think this is what this event is tapping into, those kind of nostalgic moments of younger, when you were younger, and the cars that you kind
Volvo
of saw.
Burgundy Estate.
Lovely.
That was our car of choice.
That's a classic now, Georgie. I tell you, if you'd held on to that, low mileage on the clock, you'd have enough for a house deposit somewhere in Zone 6.
low mileage, though, to be fair. But yeah. I think that's well up the classic Burgundy Volvo Estate. That's got to be in a Festival of the Mundane, right?
Yes, and the Festival of the Unexceptional started a few years ago as a bit of a joke, but actually it's become really, really popular. People love it. And people, if you go to classic car stuff, which I do quite regularly, people love just normal cars. Yes, the Ferraris and the Porsches and everything attract lots of people, but people love, you know, just to see stuff that was just a bit run-of-the-mill, or even just a bit naff or something. Or not naff, but was just a sort of underrated, or just unusual, or just something they used to see all the time and they don't see anymore. So I went to a classic car show yesterday evening, in fact. Classics on the Common in Harpenden, which is on every year. Again, it's free. Brilliant. people come, they park their classic cars up on the Common, and people come and wander around on a summer's evening. And yesterday was a great summer's evening to do it. But amongst all the exotica on show there, stuff that was attracting people's attention included a diesel Citroen BX that had loads of people around it taking photographs, a Vauxhall Cavalier convertible.
Oh.
I mean, you were really rolling if you had a Cavalier convertible back in the day, and if you kept it in mint condition, you'd have a crowd around you now. And other sort of just bog standard normal cars. Any kind of old Ford always draws a massive crowd, and even someone with a Nova, an old Vauxhall Nova, will get a big crowd around them. So
wow,
you know, and this is the kind of classic car that's acceptable to lots of people. You could get into the ownership of a classic car, have fun driving around in one, go to shows, chat to people will come around, look at your car for £1,500.
I can tell you a Vauxhall Cavalier convertible does not look like a robot in disguise.
Yeah. So I was lucky. My dad used to get company cars. My favourite one from when I was little was he had a Rover SD1 They were the very swoopy-looking Rovers. They were really, really good cars. Looked a little bit like a Ferrari Daytona, everyone says, although they look quite a lot different to a Ferrari Daytona.
You squinted.
Yeah, they had a massive... they were a hatchback. They were a very sort of a coupe-style four-door car that had a hatchback, a huge boot. I remember when there was too many of us to all sit in the seat, some of us would sit in the boot of the car and be driven around, and you could look out the glass hatchback, you know. People had slightly less concern over road safety back in the day. And then my other favourite car that he had after that was a Saab 9000 Turbo, which back in those days was a seriously quick car.
Simon, what about your classic cars? I would say that you've got a sort of classic mundane car.
I do. I've got a Peugeot 205 GTI, but that's not really a mundane car. That was considered like one of the best of the bunch in terms of the hot hatches back in the day.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it mundane, as in it was quite a familiar sight.
Yeah, it was an everyman car.
It was
a familiar sight on the road, and now you hardly see any of them. And if when I go out in it, almost without fail, someone will stop you, talk to you at the petrol station, shout out the window of another car at you. I drove home the other day and I had one bloke on a bike stop and talk to me. And it's good when you have a cyclist stop and talk to and you're driving and they're being positive. And then a guy walking past and everything. But yeah, you'd get that. If you were driving around in a Maestro or a Montego, I guarantee you'd get that as well. But a more mundane version would be to have like a cooking version of the car, the old 1.1 litre one, and then drive around that and cherish it as a classic. But I guarantee you'd still get people come up and talk to you if you had one of those as well.
Nothing beats the burgundy Volvo, though. You can stay... Well, actually, that's not true. A 300-something thousand car might. So do please get in contact with us if you have spanked that sort of money on a car ever, because I want to know who you are. But if you want to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news, just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you do want to get in contact with us, anything you want us to investigate, including thousands of pounds cars,
email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us at thisismoney, and come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you can find all the podcasts past, and you can join in the conversation in reader comments and tell us about the best car that your mum or dad had.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.